We need to start thinking about how we validate information online, similar to the way that professional fact checkers do.
That's Wayne Jurnell, professor of teacher education at the University of North Carolina, Greensboro. His research focuses on the teaching of politics in secondary schools, and he's conducted several studies on teaching about elections. On this episode, I'll talk to Wayne about how and why educators should teach about the electoral process, and also how students can learn to navigate our complex media landscape. And this is Education for Sustainable Democracy. I'm Brett Levy, and I'm an associate professor of education at the University at Albany, State University of New York. If you like the show, please click the subscribe button and share it with a friend or colleague. Here's my interview with Wayne Jurnell. Wayne, it is great to talk to you. Thank you so much for coming on to the show.
Glad to be here.
So, Wayne, you've conducted research in classrooms on how teachers teach about elections and how students learn about elections. And here we are in the midst of a very heated political season. What would you say to teachers who are hesitant to teach about the election because they're concerned about the challenges of maintaining a productive learning environment when there are strong disagreements and heated emotions among their students?
So the first thing that I think is always important is to remind students, and sometimes we have to remind ourselves as well, that this is going to be a close election. There are going to be millions of people who vote for Donald Trump. There's going to be millions of people who vote for Joe Biden. So it's not like we are dealing with something out of the ordinary, right? This is what happens in every presidential election. People feel strongly about the candidates, and unfortunately, one person's going to win and one person's going to lose. And I think that's important for everybody to kind of understand right up front, because we've become so siloed and polarized that we find it hard to imagine the other side winning. But there's millions of people on both sides. So I think when you frame it that way to start out with and just kind of keep reminding students of that, it's an easy way to step back a little bit, realize that your own perspective is not the only perspective out there. And you might feel strongly about it, but you got to realize that other people feel strongly as well. And that's why we have elections. That's why we vote.
That's great, Wayne. That's a really helpful perspective for young people to develop. There are winners and there are losers in elections. And we have to accept that that's part of living in a democratic system, even if it can be disappointing at times. But I'm wondering what you might say to educators who are concerned that some of their students might come to the classroom or their online learning environments with a lot of passion and excitement that can be dismissive of the opposing perspective?
Yeah, it's a good question. I don't know if a blanket statement will answer that. It depends on the topic that gets people fired up, right? So, like, think back to the 2016 election when Donald Trump had his Access Hollywood moment. And, you know, that obviously fired people up. I think it's incumbent on teachers to come out and say specifically, you know, that what he said was wrong, you know, and make no bones about it. What he said was wrong. That was inappropriate. It was describing sexual assault, which is, you know, something that we shouldn't tolerate. And then you can go further and say, you know, we're not going to discuss the merits of that. You know, I think a teacher has a responsibility to shut that down. But then go into the discussion of, is that disqualifying for a president? Now, some people felt very strongly that it was, but it obviously wasn't, because Donald Trump's in the White House right now. You know, when students come in fired up, which isn't a bad thing, we want them fired up, right? That means they're paying attention. That means they're engaged. You know, thinking about like Judy Pace's work on a charged classroom. You want your students to be charged, not dead, right? But at the same time, we want to make sure that those passions are funneled into productive ways. It's not productive to discuss the merits of sexual assault. It is productive to discuss the merits of what is disqualifying to be elected, what's not disqualifying. So Donald Trump tweets a lot of things, and it's really easy to get focused on, you know, some of the, you know, outrageous things that he says. I think teachers would be, you know, well-intentioned to denounce things that deserve denouncing, but then spend most of the time focusing on things where there are multiple rational opinions. So it kind of goes back to Diana Hess's work on open and settled issues.
Yes, definitely. So you, like Diana Hess, are arguing that we should shut down discussion and debate about issues that are closed and decided, especially moral questions, and
right.
focus our attention on more open questions and enable students to explore these substantively and reserve enough time for that. But there still are many teachers who, for a variety of reasons, are hesitant to teach about the election and may not have taught about it yet. In the coming days and weeks, it will still be a very current issue, and they may choose to do so. In your recent article in Social Education, you argued that educators absolutely should seize this moment and teach about the election. Could you summarize your argument?
Sure. And I think it depends on whether teachers are teaching, like, say, civics or government versus, say, U.S. history. So let's start with the U.S. history. Let's say you're teaching U.S. history. You know, there are definitely parallels that you can make from, you know, U.S. history to the present day, to the current election. So, like, for example, if you were teaching about the 1876 election, which was a contested election, that would be a perfect opportunity to bring in what's going to happen here in 2020 with the mail-in ballots and the potential there. But obviously not every topic in U.S. history is going to connect back to the 2020 election. I do think it's important, though, for teachers teaching world history or U.S. history to take time, 10, 15, 20 minutes each day, to make sure students are aware of what's going on and just do kind of like a recap of the days up to the election, that sort of stuff. Now, if you're teaching civics or government, I would argue that teachers have an obligation to really redesign your curriculum so that it is election focused. If you really think about it, there's not much in a civics or government curriculum that you could not connect directly to what's going on in the 2020 election, whether you're talking about the judicial branch and the Supreme Court and obviously the stuff with the executive branch and units on political parties. I studied a teacher back in the 2012 election who really took this idea of putting the election in the forefront to heart, and he completely just redesigned his entire curriculum so that everything revolved around the election. It was a semester-long project, and it ended with a school-wide mock election. And based on my study, the students, I would argue, in that class were more informed about the 2012 election than the average American was. And it's a shame they couldn't vote. They were too young.
Yeah, that's really interesting. So based on your study, how would you say that students exploring civics and government in the context of an election affected what they learned about civics and government?
When you teach civics or government, sometimes it comes across as very technical, right? You know, the bill into law process, that, you know, on paper, it looks really easy. But what the textbook doesn't talk about are the things like lobbyists and, you know, all the other inside baseball that occurs before a bill can actually be signed into law. Same thing happens with any aspect of government. When you can attach it to something that's authentic, like the 2012 election in that case, the teacher was able to really take what he would normally be teaching. It's not like he cut anything from the curriculum. Instead, he used the election to enhance what he would already be teaching. And so, you know, it allowed the students to really kind of see civics and government in action when he related it to the election, rather than just the textbook version of civics and government.
Yes, I definitely agree that contextualizing academic learning in the real world, like current events, can be hugely beneficial for students. It can enhance their motivation and ultimately their learning. So it's really cool to hear that example that you just described from your research. I'm wondering if you could talk more about your research on teaching and learning about elections. You've done a number of studies in this area, so could you talk a bit more about your findings?
Sure. So the first thing would be the fact that they, you know, should teach it. You'd be surprised that even in a civics or government class, much less social studies writ large, a lot of teachers just refuse to teach it, either because it's not part of their formal curriculum, or two, they're just afraid to teach it. That they know that the tensions are rising high and, you know, people are going to be upset. The other night in my social studies methods course, I asked my student teachers who are out in the field right now. They're in their internships and they're, you know, observing teachers in the field. And I asked them how many of their teachers have talked about the election in their classes. Out of 19 students, only 3 raised their hand. And to me, that is social studies malpractice. So, you know, I know that seems like a very low bar to set, but just being able to talk about it, be knowledgeable about it, you know, teach them about things like the Electoral College so that they're not surprised on election day. The other thing that's come out of my research is along those lines is teaching about the election should be taught at all levels. In my 2008 study, when I studied that election, I was studying six classes in three different high schools. And what I found was students in advanced classes got really detailed, nuanced election coverage. You know, I studied a private Catholic school. I studied a low socioeconomic urban school and a predominantly white rural school. And the students in the Catholic school and the predominantly white rural school tended to get pretty good election coverage. Whereas in the urban school, unless it was an honors class, it really wasn't taught that much. And so as a result, these students who were within a 5-mile geographical area of each other almost received vastly different educational, you know, instruction. And it was kind of sad to see how much this one group who tended to be more privileged in their education knew more about the election than the students in the urban school. You know, when I talked to the teachers at that urban school, there was a lot of different reasons for why they didn't teach the election as detailed, ranging from, you know, they felt like they had to teach to the test and they didn't feel like they had time, or they didn't feel like their students could handle it, or that they themselves weren't prepared to teach the election and they were afraid of student pushback. So in other words, I think, you know, another thing that I've seen from my research is that teaching elections needs to be across the board. It's something that every student should be allowed to learn. I think the fear that teachers have about teaching the election is largely unfounded. And I understand why teachers are afraid. It's because they've seen on television, you know, occasionally a teacher gets in trouble and makes it on cable news because in the way that the news frames it is that they were getting too political in class and, you know, that sort of stuff. The problem is, if you really think about it, and you look at those news stories, it's not so much that teachers got in trouble for teaching about politics. It was how they taught about it. You know, occasionally they'll get in yelling matches with their students and things like that. Of course, that's going to be something that teachers shouldn't do. It's just like any other aspect of classroom management. But unfortunately, I think teachers have seen these stories and they get, of course, shared on social media. And there's this fear that I don't want to be that teacher that gets on social media. And I totally get that. But when you deal with social studies, there is going to be a certain amount of controversy, not just in civics and government, but in all aspects of social studies. And you can't deprive your students of a good civic education opportunity just because you're afraid that a parent might get upset.
Yes, I definitely hear what you're saying, Wayne, and I completely agree with you. But for teachers, especially new teachers who may be concerned that parents or administrators might respond negatively to something that they teach about, what do you think they could do to reduce the likelihood that that would happen?
One thing that I've encouraged teachers to do, and I've seen teachers do this in practice as well, is if they know they're going to be talking about something controversial, and of course the election would be controversial, run it by the administrator first and let them give them an idea of, one, what you're going to be doing, why you're going to be doing it, and, you know, providing that, you know, pedagogical justification for what you're doing. And I think as long as the administrator has your side of the equation up front, when they do occasionally get a call from a parent that says, well, this teacher is indoctrinating my child, they'll at least have an idea that say the parents probably overreacted.
Mm-hmm. Well, in some of my own research and in communities across the country, we've seen that some parents are very concerned that educators might impose their own political perspectives on their students. Many educators don't disclose their political perspectives at all or try to avoid doing so, but some do. In one of your recent articles, you argue that it's okay for educators to disclose their political perspectives, especially under certain conditions. Could you explain your argument?
It's a great question. So anybody that's been in the classroom knows that the first question that gets asked, who are you going to vote for, right? Students like knowing where their teacher stands, as long as they don't feel like their teacher is trying to force them to adhere to the same views. So what I think is appropriate for teaching about elections and teaching about politics in general is taking what Thomas Kelly called a committed impartiality approach. And that approach basically allows teachers to disclose their political beliefs, but at the same time saying, my belief does not make it right. Your belief is just as valid as my belief. And if we disagree, that's perfectly fine. There's in no way will the teacher hold students' political opinions against them if they disagree. The reason why I think a community impartiality approach is useful in a classroom is that it provides much needed context for students. I've sat through many teachers' classrooms during my research on teaching elections, and the vast majority of them would not disclose their political preference to their students because they wanted to have this air of neutrality in the classroom. The problem is there is no such thing as a neutral classroom. Teachers may not knowingly or purposefully, you know, show their biases in their classroom, but it happens. And so, you know, as someone who was politically savvy, I was sitting in the back of the classroom just jotting down notes every time the teacher said things that were partisan. Now, I knew who the teacher was voting for, and I knew, you know, I was able to put that comment into a certain context. But the students didn't have that, you know, knowledge that I had. And so, unfortunately, a lot of times, if you don't take a committed impartiality approach, I think you actually run a better chance of indoctrinating your students because of the potential for students to see their teacher's opinions as facts.
That's interesting. So could you give an example of an opinion stated by a teacher that a student might view as a fact?
Sure. So I'll give you an example from the 2008 election. I had two teachers who were very adamant that someone who, they didn't necessarily come out and say that Barack Obama was a Muslim, but they definitely didn't refute it either. But they came out and said that someone who is Muslim should not be a candidate for president, even though we know that there is no religious litmus test to be a president. And so if students knew that those teachers were supporting McCain, that might have been able to categorize those responses a little bit. Whereas, you know, when I interviewed students from those classes where the teachers didn't disclose, you know, some of the students really couldn't place where their teacher fell. And some of them, when I was interviewing them, they had a hard time really separating what I would consider just basic facts about the election from their teacher's opinion.
So you're arguing that in order to help students understand where their teachers are coming from, their teachers should disclose their perspectives, but still be committed to being impartial. Have you ever seen a teacher do a good job taking on this role of committed impartiality?
Oh, yeah, I have, actually. In the 2008 election, there was one teacher who, it was the teacher from the white rural school, and he was a McCain supporter, and he let his students know, and his students, by and large, were Obama supporters. So it's not like they were in agreement. And, you know, what I found in that study was he actually generated more substantive discussions because he was able to use that context that the students knew that he was voting for McCain to kind of push back a little bit on when his students got so pro-Obama, right? So they actually had a nice relationship there. What he didn't have to do was play the devil's advocate, right? So a lot of times teachers will play the devil's advocate, but without that context, it's hard to know that the teacher's actually playing the devil's advocate there and not just, you know, regurgitating their own opinions and that sort of stuff. So, you know, most of the teachers that I've observed in my studies have not disclosed, but a couple of them have, and one of them that I would say definitely did fell right into what Thomas Kelly would describe as committed impartiality. The other one that disclosed that immediately comes to mind was what Thomas Kelly would call exclusive partiality. He would disclose, but he did not disclose in a tolerant way, and he would tell students that they were wrong and things like that. So it wasn't necessarily something that you would want pre-service teachers necessarily to emulate. But what was interesting is when I interviewed students from that class, they all said they appreciated knowing where their teacher stood. And so the teacher was very liberal, and he was very much for Obama. And he would, you know, say things like Republicans are stupid and things like that that we don't want teachers to do. Even when I interviewed conservative students from that class, they loved the teacher and they said that, you know, knowing his opinions helped put what he said into certain contexts. And they would go and, you know, do research on their own to try to, you know, debunk his, you know, bias claims and things like that. So even when a teacher's acting inappropriately, it's not necessarily a bad thing when they disclose, although we want them to do committed impartiality. Now, the last thing I'll say about committed impartiality is the other main benefit that I see from it is when it's done correctly, like the teacher that in that white rural school in 2008 that I was talking about, it really allows for the teacher to model political tolerance. And unfortunately, students, if they're not seeing political tolerance in their classrooms, it's hard to see where they're getting it. I mean, they're sure as heck not getting it on social media. They're not getting it on cable news. Hopefully they're getting it with their family, but oftentimes they're probably not. So if we think about classrooms like Dewey thought about them as laboratories of democracy and how we're supposed to learn to interact with people who may disagree with us, it's important that we do these things in K-12 schooling, and giving deference to opinions that go against your own personal worldviews is a tough thing. It's an unnatural thing. And so for teachers to be able to model that for students is important.
Yes, absolutely, Wayne. Modeling tolerance, that can be a hugely important role for educators to play. I want to shift topics for a bit because I know that you also have expertise in media literacy education. And this is a time when there's a lot of fake news out there. So how do you think educators should guide students to navigate the media landscape during an election and beyond?
What students need to know is that old media literacy tricks that they may have been taught in K-12 schools don't necessarily work, right? So I don't know if you have looked at the work by the Stanford History Education mm-hmm, Group. Mm-hmm. And what they found is that middle school students, high school students, and college students, they really are not very adept at figuring out what is reliable information online. And they've done a lot of really good research to show that we need to start thinking about how we validate information online, similar to the way that professional fact checkers do. We shouldn't take one particular piece of information that we find online and try to evaluate it on its own merits. Instead, we should, what they call reading laterally. We should open up new tabs and try to really corroborate information based on what we know are truly reputable sources. The problem is there's so many sources out there, it's impossible to just teach students what is a good source and what is a bad source. So one of the things that I like to do is I like to have three or four, you know, what I consider reliable sources that span the political spectrum. So like on the conservative side, I look at things like the Wall Street Journal. On the liberal side, I look at things like the New York Times and the Washington Post, which they do have bias in them. There's no doubt about that. But bias is different than accuracy. And so even though that the Wall Street Journal and, you know, the New York Times might cover the same story in different ways, they're going to be reporting on the facts. So when I see a meme or something that just doesn't seem right, those are kind of the websites that I go to verify it. Unfortunately, too many people these days don't take that extra step. They just take things on face value, which then gets into the question of why do they do that? And the reason why they do that is because they're human. We're all human. We don't like to be wrong. There's research out there that talks about, you know, motivated reasoning and confirmation bias and how as humans, we are susceptible to that. We encounter new information in ways that fits into what we already believe. We watch the news not to gain new information or to, you know, challenge our own worldviews, but instead we watch the news to say, damn right, that's what I already believed, and they're reinforcing that. So educating students to understand those things like confirmation bias and motivated reasoning and how it happens to the best of us. I mean, I'm guilty of it. I'm sure you've been guilty of it as well. It's not anything to be ashamed of, but it's something to be aware of. And if we're not aware of it, then we're just going to be siloing ourselves into echo chambers, both in our personal lives and our lives on social media. And the more that we do that, the less informed we are.
Yeah, I agree that this is a huge issue that we need to be concerned about. And you've mentioned a number of concepts and skills that young people can develop that can really help them to navigate the new media landscape. And that's great. But I wonder about the importance of developing new habits based on these concepts and skills. You know, what should the habits of information consumers in the digital age be? And how can we mm-hmm. help young people develop these habits and practice them?
No, I agree 100%. I mean, the whole point of practice, like you said, is important. And that's why I think as educators, one of the best things that teachers can do is model appropriate fact checking. It's one thing to tell students that you need to look at other, you know, multiple, you know, sites to get accurate information. It's another thing to walk students through it. You know, show students, it's kind of like in math, you know, just getting the right answer is one thing, but you want to show your work. The same thing applies here. You know, getting the accurate information is important, but for an educational standpoint, from a teacher's perspective, you want to be able to show students your work. And the more you model it and the more you have students practice it, the better at it they're going to be, because it is a skill.
Wayne, it's been really great to talk to you. Thank you so much for coming on to the show.
See ya.
Bye-bye. Bye. That was Wayne Jurnell, professor of teacher education at the University of North Carolina, Greensboro. Wayne also serves as the editor of Theory and Research in Social Education, the premier research journal in social studies education. To learn more about Wayne's work, including his article on teaching the 2020 election, please click on the links in the show notes. And this is Education for Sustainable Democracy. I'm Brett Levy. To learn more about the show and to check out our other episodes, please visit www.esdpodcast.org. That's esdpodcast.org. This is a new show, so if you like it, please let your friends and colleagues know about it. Thank you for listening.